Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. You know what we've got to talk about today. President Barack Obama today nominated Solicitor General Elena Kagan to the United States Supreme Court to serve as Associate Justice in the seat vacated by the retiring Justice John Paul Stevens. The Solicitor General of the United States today stood with the President as she was introduced as his nominee for the nation's high court, and this sets the stage, you know it does, for a very interesting process. The confirmation process before the Senate Judiciary Committee and the total United States Senate, and what could be, but isn't always, a really good discussion of the crucial issues at stake before the watching nation. I hope it is one of those crucial, really productive exchanges where we actually talk about the issues that matter. I would hope that the United States Senate and the Senate's Judiciary Committee would conduct hearings that would lead to the right kind of questions and the right kind of discussion. But, you know, I'm not going to count on that. That's why I'm going to turn to you today and say that's our job. Today, it's our job to talk about what this means. I want to invite you to join with me. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let me tell you, I think there are a lot of citizens who think when you're talking about a nomination to the United States Supreme Court, that's kind of over our pay grade. That's higher than most of us are probably willing to enter into a conversation. Well, let's get rid of that. That is how the court becomes unaccountable to the people. This is the people's court. It is the people's constitution, and it is our responsibility, formally through our elected representatives in the United States Senate, constitutionally so, but also in a very real and substantial way, it's our responsibility to talk about this. I'm hopeful that we will have, over the next several weeks and months, a good discussion about what it means to interpret the Constitution, what it means to respect and to understand the rule of law, what it means for a person to be nominated to the Supreme Court, and why it matters. We're going to be talking about that today on the Albert Mohler Program. Again, the phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We will get to that in just a moment. First, to review some other issues in the news, I published an article today at my website at albertmohler.com on the moral life of babies. I entitled my article, The Moral Life of Babies and the Ideological Life of Adults. And the reason for that is pretty simple. The article that is found in the New York Times Magazine's The Cover Story in yesterday's edition is entitled The Moral Life of Babies. It's by Paul Bloom, a professor of psychology at Yale. And the article really is interesting. And, you know, as a matter of fact, as I mentioned in my article, the New York Times Magazine has become one of the most interesting places to find an exchange of ideas. Paul Bloom writes that we may often think that babies are not yet possessing a moral sense, but we'd be wrong, he argues. Now, there's some fascinating questions. Did you know that at Yale University, it's something known as the Infant Cognition Center? It's often known as the Baby Lab at Yale. And at the Baby Lab at Yale, they study babies and they try to determine just what they know and they don't know, how they process information. That's why it's called the Infant Cognition Center. But, you know, infants are very difficult to study in this way. The obvious reason they're difficult is because they can't talk, and most psychological tests require language. So you got to come up with some other way to study what infants are thinking, what infants like, what they dislike, what they're judging, how they're thinking. And that's why they use something what is called looking time. No kidding. They focus on how babies use their eyes to focus on certain things, how long they focus on them, and what other kinds of responses come with the focus. Now, just to get to the bottom line of this research, Paul Bloom and his associates at Yale have tried to point out that children, indeed infants, have some moral knowledge and moral sense. You'd be interested to read the article and find out how they tested that. But basically, they put babies in a position where you might say there's a good character and a bad character, and the babies obviously liked the good character. They liked the character who behaved in the more morally upright ways rather than the wrong ways. All to say that babies evidently have some very innate sense of right and wrong. It's a rudimentary sense. It's a gut instinct, or it's at a gut level, says Paul Bloom and his associates. But the bottom line is that they are not the blank slates. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, you'll recall that name, a famous French philosopher, called the human infant, quote, a perfect idiot. William James, who, among other things, founded the psychology department at Harvard University at the turn of the last century, summarized the infant's mental state as, quote, one great blooming, buzzing confusion. Well, it turns out not quite so much. Not quite so much. Now, what makes this article really interesting and why I felt like I had to write about it is that Paul Bloom is explicitly, honestly, straightforwardly, not going to hide it from you, committed to an evolutionary worldview. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important for this reason. If indeed babies are born with a moral knowledge that isn't necessary by evolution, it would tend to discount evolution. In other words, evolution can't account for that alone. And as a matter of fact, Paul Bloom and his associates admit evolution can't account for the human moral sense alone. There has to be some other explanation. Now, when you have adults, then you have the explanation of cultural learning. You know, to that innate sense is added the more sophisticated, higher level moral reasoning that comes from the culture. But with infants, you don't have that. And it's really interesting to see that Paul Bloom acknowledges the problem. I give him credit for that. But, you know, at the end of the day, evolution just can't account for this. And that's why I mentioned in my article that for Christians, we need to have the very quick understanding that this is really an indication of what is known theologically as the imago Dei, the image of God. We are made God's image. That's exactly what the book of Genesis tells us. He made human beings. God made human beings in his image. And a part of what it means to be made the image of God is that we are moral creatures. In distinction to the animals, we are moral creatures. Yesterday, I did something a bit unusual. I found a couple of little tiny baby raccoons that were in grave danger. They were obviously orphaned, and they were wandering in traffic in a very busy place here in Louisville. And I just didn't feel like we could leave them. And so with someone else who stopped, I managed to get them. We got them in a box, and I brought them home. Hello, sweetheart. Guess what I brought home? These two tiny, tiny, tiny little raccoons. They were smaller than my fist and just tiny little critters. And let me tell you what, they were as helpless as they could be. But you know what? Those little raccoons are going to grow up, Lord willing, to be big raccoons. Won't be quite so cute anymore. But you know what? They're not going to acquire moral knowledge. They're going to grow in other ways. They're going to develop. But a raccoon is never going to develop into a moral philosopher. A raccoon is never going to act on the basis of what is right and wrong. A raccoon is never going to go hide in the corner because it's embarrassed for its behavior. A raccoon is never going to develop that kind of moral knowledge. That just isn't what animals have. But human beings are different. And it starts very early. And I drew attention to this article because it isn't about evolution. The scripture tells us that the Creator made us in his image and he made us moral beings and he holds us accountable. And the very fact that in infants now, the Infant Cognition Center at Yale University says, it turns out babies have a moral knowledge we didn't know was there. Well, those of us who know the scripture should be the people who are first in line to say, well, we know what that means. Every single human being is made the image of God. Every single human being has a knowledge that is not implanted within us by some blind, materialistic, naturalistic force called evolution, but rather by the Creator. And so of all things, from the Infant Cognition Center at Yale University and from the cover story in yesterday's edition of the New York Times Magazine comes a deeper understanding for those of us who understand the Scriptures and believe the Scriptures that what it means to be human is to be a moral creature. Not just acquired at some point in our development, but from the very beginning. We're going to come back to talk about the nomination of Elena Kagan to the U.S. Supreme Court and invite your conversation. Call us at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Today is a very interesting day in history. 70 years ago today, 7-0, 70 years ago to this day, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain resigned. That name, you may recall, goes down in history as the great appeaser of Adolf Hitler in the failed attempt at the appeasement of the Nazi dictator. Munich, 1938, one of those dates that will live in infamy. And then you fast forward to May of 1940, Neville Chamberlain's government had lost all popular support and he resigned. That same day, King George VI asked Winston Churchill to come out of the political wilderness and form a government as prime minister. Almost anyone looking back at those years knows that that was an incredible turning point in the history of England and the history of World War II when Winston Churchill took office as British Prime Minister. Neville Chamberlain resigned 70 years ago today. And today, in Great Britain, Prime Minister Gordon Brown announced his resignation in the aftermath of colossal defeats in the general election. Another turning point in history, not quite so significant, but I'll tell you, some advisor around Gordon Brown should have suggested to him that it would not look good to resign on the 70th anniversary of the resignation of Neville Chamberlain. I would have waited a day. We're going to come back to talk right now about intelligent Christian conversation when it comes to what we should look for in the confirmation process of the new nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court, Elena Kagan. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. We'll be right back with your calls on the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. A lot of attention, of course, as President Obama was considering whom he would nominate to the U.S. Supreme Court in the aftermath of the resignation announcement by retiring Justice John Paul Stevens. From the very beginning, one name was very close to the top, and that is the name of Elena Kagan, the Solicitor General of the United States, first woman to serve as Dean of the Harvard Law School, and someone who has known Barack Obama since they were together at the University of Chicago back in the 1990s. But the announcement made today, even as it really surprised no one, sets the stage for a very interesting discussion about the role of the justice, about the role of the court, about the role of the Constitution, about what justices do when it comes to interpreting the Constitution and why it matters. You know, I like this kind of confirmation hearing. I think this is one of the greatest opportunities in a deliberative democracy to have some of the most important issues really thrown out for discussion. I get frustrated at times because the Senate is made up of people who oftentimes like to talk more than to listen. But nonetheless, the Senate is still the United States Senate. It is still the most rarefied club in America. It is still where the most important issues can, at least potentially, get a good hearing. And let's hope that's what happens. Who in the world is Elena Kagan? Well, she's 50, unmarried. And at age 50, it means she can serve a very long time on the court, which is something that we were warned or advised this president was looking for because he wants long-term influence. She is opaque. I don't think anyone has described this better than Dahlia Lithwick at Slate Magazine, who quotes Jeffrey Toobin, another very, very interesting legal scholar in the United States, who was her law school study partner, is saying that he has virtually no idea what she really believes. And there are others who say the same thing. Nina Totenberg of NPR said, quote, Elena is the single most competitive and most inscrutable person I've ever known. Well, we do know certain things about her. She's certainly on the more progressive or liberal side of the ideological equation. That's clear. But we also know that while she was the dean of the Harvard Law School, and by the way, she inherited a very difficult position there. She reached out to conservatives. At least she knows how to talk to conservatives. And she at Harvard Law School deserves credit for at least bringing some order out of that chaos. By the way, as I was talking to some people earlier today, I pointed out, if you can make it through the vetting process to be dean of the Harvard Law School, given all the ideological combat that goes on there, the United States Senate just might look like they're playing softball. But nonetheless, there are big issues here to be discussed. I want to know what questions you hope will be out there and will be asked of this nominee. I want to know what you're thinking about this process, what you think of Elena Kagan, and what you think we ought to be talking about, thinking about. Don't you just defer this to the United States Senate and say that's their job. It is their constitutional responsibility. But this is the people's court. This is a government of the people, by the people, for the people. And there is no way that this government works as a long-term and enduring project if American citizens say it isn't our job to talk about this. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. You know how important this is. The U.S. Supreme Court has become more important now, arguably, than at any point in its previous history. The United States Supreme Court is where so many of the most contentious and important issues are adjudicated by our government. And when it comes right down to it, whether this was the founders' intention or whether this is the usurpation of power and authority by the court, when you talk about the three branches of government, have you thought about the fact that in reality, the president and the Congress are often conscribed by the court, but they have a very difficult time actually limiting the court? There is judicial review, whereby the court reviews the actions of Congress and the actions of the president, But where is the judicial review for the judiciary? Well, the Supreme Court's pretty much the be-all and end-all there. It comes down to the interpretation of a text, too, because the Supreme Court's responsibility is to adjudicate according to the Constitution of the United States of America. But that means they're looking at a written document and telling us this is what it means today. And that's why time and time again I point out that Christians, conservative Christians in particular, have a real interest in this because the task of interpreting the Constitution and interpreting the Bible are very much analogous. They're very similar. The same temptations, the same ideological issues come to the fore when talking about the U.S. Constitution or the Scripture. Of course, what we're looking at here is a liberal Democratic president making a nominee. This is not likely, making a nomination, that is, this is not likely to shift the balance of power on the court because Justice John Paul Stevens, the retiring justice, was himself the predictably liberal vote on the crucial liberal conservative issues. But nonetheless, given her age and given what is conceded to be her formidable intellect, it's expected she'll have not only a long tenure, but probably a good deal of influence as well. A couple of things are being said about Elena Kagan immediately, even though she is the Solicitor General of the United States and has been so for over a year. And even as she has had previous administration experience in the Clinton administration, even as she was dean of the Harvard Law School for 6 years, she's never served as a judge. And that means there is no judicial paper trail. Generally, by the time someone comes to the U.S. Supreme Court as a nominee, there is a long and growing body of case law and decisions and court documents and legal opinions that that really become the fodder for conversation. Not so with Elena Kagan. She never served as a judge. On the other hand, there's some people who are pointing out that just may be a strength that she never served as a judge, because after all, she has different kinds of experience, including political experience within the White House. Now, some of the same people saying that, by the way, weren't saying that when they were talking about the political experience of Chief Justice John Roberts during his confirmation hearings. But this is politics when it comes to this nomination fight. There's no doubt about it. And in politics, you can expect just about everything that can be said to be said. But what should we be talking about? The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. Let's go to Eileen, calling from Tampa, Florida, listening to WTBN. Go ahead, Eileen. What are you thinking?
Thank you for taking that call. What I'm thinking is, I'll even take the human resources field. When you are looking for qualified candidates for even something like an administrative assistant, there are certain minimum requirements for a position like that or any other position. And so it seems as though for this level of position in the country that there ought to be minimum requirements someone has to meet to even be considered. And I don't believe Ms. Kagan meets those minimum requirements, which to me would be bench experience.
Yeah, so the bench experience is a big issue to you, Eileen. I appreciate your call from there in Tampa. And I think it's fascinating you refer to this as kind of a human resources approach because that's exactly what it is. And I think most people are probably thinking exactly what you're thinking. You know, when you look for someone who's going to be serving as a judge or justice on the court, which is the highest in the land, you'd expect that person probably to have some kind of previous court experience. That's not the case with Elena Kagan, no doubt about it. It is generally the case. It hasn't been always the case. In the history of the U.S. Supreme Court, there have been different ways of getting on the court. One of them has been the more academic kind of appointment. There have been justices who've been added right out of law schools, generally with a long teaching and tenure. The other is political. And I guess the greatest example of that is Chief Justice Earl Warren, who was named by President Eisenhower, who had served as governor of California and then was appointed to be Chief Justice of the United States. So there's some very interesting ways to get there. Eileen says she's concerned because Elena Kagan has never served as a judge. I'll tell you the greatest thing that leads me to agree with that concern to some extent is that means there's no data, there is no body of judicial decisions and opinions that would allow us to judge exactly where Elena Kagan stands and how she would interpret the Constitution. I wish I had that data. I'll tell you that. I think there'll be a lot of senators who are going to say, we wish we had that data. What are you looking for? What should we be talking about? The phone number, 877-893-8255. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. If you ask me my opinion of this from the political analysis, I'll tell you, I think this is a very smart move by President Obama. I'll tell you what I think he's done. I think he's appointed someone who will probably bring about the least combustible kind of confirmation hearings. Now, that's just an anticipation. You can never assure that anything will go exactly like you would expect, but this is a woman who seems to have very few enemies and lots of friends. This is a woman who's respected as an intellect, even as she's understood to be a liberal. This is a woman who doesn't have a long track record of things that people are going to be able to dig through judicially. She's never been a judge. And this is a woman who's been vetted more than once by White House for a major position in the last position, of course, just months ago, being confirmed as Solicitor General of the United States. So I think from a political aspect, President Obama is probably pretty wise in this, because this avoids the president and the White House having to deal with the summer consumed by a confirmation fight. On the other hand, you just never know. And from a different kind of analysis, just because it is politically expedient doesn't mean there are not huge worldview issues at stake here that we need to be concerned about. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Sanford's listening on WFIA. What do you think in Sanford?
Well, Dr. Mohler, my concern would be not justices not trying to pull in laws from other cultures to change our laws. For example, using actual laws from France or Germany, to basically justify their stance and watering down our Constitution.
Yeah, I think it's a very legitimate concern, Sanford, and it raises one of the crucial issues right now of constitutional interpretation, and that is, are we interpreting this Constitution, or are we somehow morally and intellectually obligated to consider the constitutional interpretation and the constitutional structures of other nations? And Sanford's raised a very real and present danger. Not long ago, Justices Breyer and Scalia faced off over this question, and it was a pretty honest exchange, with Justice Breyer saying, we should listen to other courts, be influenced by other courts, because we're a part of a world community. And Scalia saying, that's not our job. Our job is to interpret the United States Constitution, because that is indeed who we are, what this court is all about, and where our accountability lies. And I'll tell you, the tendency and the temptation, even the urge to pull in judicial influences from the European context, that's to pull this country in a very liberal direction. And I don't use liberal in this sense as some kind of code word or scare word. That's simply what it is. It is to liberalize our interpretation of the law in a way that better fits the far more secularized and liberalized culture of most of Europe. And, one of the interesting things to bring in to Stanford's point is, by the way, when folks start arguing about why we should bring in constitutional influences and judicial precedents from other societies, they always look to the liberal courts in Europe. They never look to the conservative courts in, say, Indonesia or Malaysia. So it's a pretty selective kind of intellectual approach that really betrays where it's coming from. Sanford, I think you raise a very good point. I hope some senator or senators ask the question just as directly as you did. Then that is Solicitor General Kagan, to what extent will you give attention to the decisions made by and precedents established by international courts and the courts of foreign countries? To what extent do you see your job as limited to the interpretation of the United States Constitution? Because if it's not limited to that, then indeed there is something other than the assignment constitutionally granted to the U.S. Supreme Court going on there. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Lots of stuff to talk about. Just imagine in your own mind what it will be to see the Solicitor General of the United States, Elena Kagan, seated at a table before the Senate's Committee on the Judiciary, answering questions about her constitutional interpretation. What kind of questions would you ask? Just imagine for a moment you're a senator in that room. What would you put on the table? What kind of question would you address And what do you hope will come out of this confirmation hearing process? The phone number is 877-893-8255. Glad to hear from you by email. Write me at mail@albertmoeller.com, at Twitter @AlbertMoeller and Moeller Radio, and at Facebook, the Albert Moeller Program. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Moeller Program. We're talking about the nomination of Elena Kagan to be the new Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Today is a huge news day. It seems like the past few weeks have been huge news weeks, and we're living in one of those very fascinating times when there are multiple issues for intelligent Christian discussion all around us. This is the one for today. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. We'll be back with your calls. Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. The confirmation hearings for Solicitor General Elena Kagan to become, according to the President's intention, the next Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court will be coming up in weeks and months ahead. Important issues to be discussed. And one of the issues I just want to put on to kind of mark your ticket on this is that this really is important. This is not just some kind of esoteric academic discussion. This really is important. All right, let's go first. I want you to hear President Obama, at least a segment of President Obama's statement made earlier today.
While we can't presume to replace Justice Stevens's wisdom or experience, I have selected a nominee who I believe embodies that same excellence, independence, integrity, and passion for the law, and who can ultimately provide that same kind of leadership on the court. Our Solicitor General and my friend, Elena Kagan.
And they are friends. As a matter of fact, the press is pretty well documented. They have a relationship going back to the University of Chicago days in the 1990s, when, according to at least one report, Elena Kagan advised Barack Obama not to go into politics, but rather to stay in the academic world. And I guess that would have changed both of their lives had it happened that way. Let's listen now to Elena Kagan responding to President Obama.
Thank you, Mr. President. I am honored and I am humbled by this nomination and by the confidence you have shown in me. During the last year, as I have served as Solicitor General, my longstanding appreciation for the Supreme Court's role in our constitutional democracy has become ever deeper and richer.
You know, this follows a set pattern. And I don't care if the president's a Republican, a Democrat, a conservative, or a liberal. It follows the same pattern. The president gets up and says, I am nominating someone who is well qualified for the position and should be speedily confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And then you have the person who is the new nominee acknowledge the nomination, and they have to do so with this wonderfully elegant and humble kind of language. Not one of them can say, I think the president's made a great choice. I think I am the best qualified person to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. And quite frankly, I look forward to the nation coming to understand the president's wisdom in nominating me. But, you know, this kind of thing can backfire. Just ask President George W. Bush asking about Harriet Myers. This can backfire in other ways. Just ask Robert Bork, another former Solicitor General to the United States who was nominated to the nation's high court. That one didn't go so well, not in the nomination hearings, and that's to the discredit of the United States Senate. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Shepherdsville, Kentucky. Ed's listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Ed.
Dr. Moeller, thanks for taking my call. If I heard you right about Supreme Court Judge Breyer when he was talking to Scalia about our worldview on the Supreme Court,
yes.
At what point would we, at what point would we have a non-American sitting on our Supreme Court so we would have a better balance of a worldview on our Supreme Court?
Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting question, Ed. And when you start looking at the influence of foreign courts, you can almost feel like at times you do have, given the way some schools of jurisprudence are headed, you do have foreign judges sitting in U.S. courts. Of course, that hasn't happened, But your point illustrates the fact that there are international influences, and there are those who are arguing straightforwardly, very honestly, that we should pay a lot of attention to the international context of law and pay heed to international precedents and all the rest. By the way, if you can Google, you can quickly find that exchange between Justices Breyer and Scalia. We'll try to put a link up at today's program at the website, just so those of you who are interested in that can follow that. Ed, you know, one of the interesting protections we have here is indeed the United States Senate. And let's remember that the president has awesome power and responsibility. The president constitutionally has the right to nominate persons to the U.S. Supreme Court, and no one else can do that. No one else can do that for him. It is his constitutional role, but that does not mean that he gets to appoint persons to the U.S. Supreme Court. The difference between nomination and appointment is huge, because a nominee has to be confirmed, and that confirmation process is a part of the advice and consent of the United States Senate, and senators now have a job to do, all 100 of them. And it'll be very interesting to see how this turns out. The Senate's means of doing this includes public hearings, and with the advent of television, this has become a moment of high drama and probably less intellectual content, no doubt about it. But on the other hand, this is a participatory democracy, and the more Americans who get to watch and who will pay attention to these hearings, the better. And that can only be good for democracy. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go very quickly. We've got another caller coming up here. And don't have the name. Let's go. Caller on line two.
Administrator, but what do you know about the Constitution?
James, this is Albert Miller. It's your turn. What are you thinking?
Well, sir, this is the problem. So many politicians, whenever they speak of our government, they always use the term, this is our democracy. And it's not a democratic government. It's a republic government. And my question, if I was talking this way, how much do you really know about the Constitution? And we're putting in the people that the administration wants. This is who we want, not somebody who's extremely qualified. Yes, you've been a college administrator at a very high level Ivy League college, but we want somebody who's going to bring back stability, who's going to bring back the Constitution. That's what's eroding our country. That's what's missing from our country.
James, thanks so much for your call. Excuse me, we're running out of time, but I appreciate your call, appreciate your voice. And, you know, when you talk about what to look for out of a justice, you are reminded again, we all are, James, that elections have consequences. And one of the consequences of this election is that the person who's making the nominations is going to be Barack Obama. And President Barack Obama is going to nominate the persons he thinks will sit on the court to rule as and to decide as he would wish. The Senate still has a role, but the Senate doesn't get to nominate. You make a very interesting point, James, about the difference between a democracy and a republic. Constitutionally, this is a republic. A republic is one form of a democratic system of government. So democracy is kind of like the big umbrella term, but the specific form of democratic government that we have is that of a republic. A republic is ruled by its constitution. The rule of law is a very important principle in American jurisprudence, and that's another issue that should have a thorough airing in the confirmation hearings of Elena Kagan in the United States Senate, as the question will be her confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. Time and time again, as we have watched the Supreme Court at work and as we have listened to the Senate deliberate confirmation hearings, it comes back to this basic, big, huge, undeniable issue. There are two main ways of interpreting the Constitution found in American law today. And the first of them is what's called an originalist position. It can be defined along a spectrum, but basically it says the Constitution means what the words say, and the words are to be interpreted in terms of what the original founders of the document and of the republic intended. And leading that particular school of interpretation is classically Justice Antonin Scalia. On the other hand, the more liberal approach is to see the Constitution as what some people call a living, breathing document. And one of the persons who perhaps is best known as the theorist in that direction is Lawrence Tribe, a professor of law at Harvard Law School, who is right now serving in a non-Senate confirmation position, but an appointed position as a legal counselor in the Obama White House. You start looking at that and you realize, well, okay, that tells you something. Barack Obama has spoken of the influence Lawrence Tribe has on him personally and had on him when he was at the Harvard Law School. Lawrence Tribe says that the Constitution is an eternally changing document, that its meaning today is not what it meant in the past. I guess no one perhaps has best articulated that understanding of the law and of the Constitution better than Ted Kennedy, the late senator from Massachusetts, who said, classically, in the confirmation hearings for Chief Justice John Roberts, he said the Constitution should be interpreted in such a way that there is a progressive unfolding of new liberties and new freedoms. You start looking at that and you realize he meant the things that were never on the view or on the minds of the founders of this country, but that that he wants to see made law through the Supreme Court today. Well, there you have those two very different directions. The understanding of the Constitution is a, quote, living, breathing document that means whatever we say it means now, and the originalist position that says it means what it meant in the first place. Now, both sides have to agree that there is no absolutely ideologically pure way to apply their own methodology. But, folks, it really does matter which way you go on this. And there is no doubt that President Obama holds to the living Constitution kind of idea, the progressivist understanding of history and of the text, and that he would appoint to the Supreme Court someone who would share that with him. I thought it was fascinating that Nina Totenberg, who's followed these things for so long for National Public Radio, says of a woman she knows, Elena Kagan, she has no idea where she is in this, the most highly competitive and inscrutable person she's ever known. Let's hope the confirmation hearing helps us to understand a good bit more about this woman who's been now appointed to one of the most important roles in this nation. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.